While the endless reality TV show that is the American presidency now continues to dominate news coverage and empty social media debates, a far more substantive debate took place this week as the 12 leading candidates for the Democratic nomination met for 3 hours in Ohio. While inside the Beltway analysis is valuable, I think it's essential to talk to expert observers in other parts of the country, especially in so-called red states. I live in one, Louisiana, and so does my first guest, Dr. Pearson Cross, who teaches political science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette and who is a longtime friend of mine. Pearson, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. Good to be here.
It was a long 3 hours, I know. did anything in Tuesday's debate stand out for you that could help us determine the direction the campaign is going in?
Well, it seemed at sometimes like there were more than 12 candidates on stage, and it did on stage, and it did seem interminable. I really think it pointed to the fact that people, including on the stage, want real answers to real questions. And that's why I think Elizabeth Warren, although she's now widely reputed to be the front runner, took some fire for not really explaining the parts of her program that were troubling, you know, about middle class taxes and so on. So I think she's going to have to be a lot more focused. But of course, this may have caught her by surprise a little bit. She's been coasting.
Yeah. I thought one dilemma that really became clear this week was how much rhetoric do the Democrats need to direct at attacking Donald Trump versus promoting a positive agenda for voters? It would seem to me that by now we've learned that Democrats attacking the president only serves to strengthen the resolve of his base more and more. What's your thought about that?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, so to speak, and that is that, you know, if you think back to the candidates who really caught fire for the Democrats, I'm going back to Jimmy Carter, or going back to Bill Clinton, certainly Barack Obama, you know, at the end of the day, they had a very positive message, and they inspired people with rhetoric that talked about a better America, about an America in the future that we could all aspire to, that we could work towards, that was something worth striving for. And it wasn't just negative. So I think right now the Democrats need to be careful that they present themselves as something other than just a bunch of naysayers.
A diverse party such as the Democrats have become obviously faces many conflicting demands. With that in mind, have you noticed any particularly important issues missing from this and maybe the previous debates in this cycle?
Well, you know, one of the good things about having this many candidates in the debate is that many of them have different issues that they focus on. Particularly one of the bad things is that they don't get enough chance to talk about it. So, for example, when Kamala Harris in the last debate said something about reproductive rights for women and access to health care, you know, she was really pointing out something that's been missing and something that's an enormous difference between Republicans and Democrats in this current election. And I think there are other issues like that, but each one, of course, Cory Booker is associated with gun rights and changing some things there. Child poverty is another issue. But certainly, you know, it's hard to really dig into the issues with this many people trying to kind of stand out, you know.
Yeah. How much unanimity do you see in these debates? And I guess it goes back to the very first question I asked you. Can you look at the debates that we've had and see a direction in which all of them are going?
I would say yes. I would say that the Democrats, by and large, range from, you know, mildly socialistic to center, not even center right, but moderate center, and that would be the farthest right. I mean, I think there's a real sense here that inequality is the big issue here, and that would be, you know, in terms of just general wealth, but also in terms of the tax structure and in terms of focusing on people that government's been captured by the interests. And I think everybody on that stage thinks that exact same thing. I think one of the things that's about this debate is, and this reaches to your previous question, is that there are commonalities that draw all these people together. Mm-hmm. And right now they're focusing on the differences and trying to exaggerate those. But frankly, everybody on that stage wants the same thing. As Cory Booker said, and I don't want to champion Cory Booker necessarily, but he said a couple of times, look, we're all against what Donald Trump is doing, and we need to remember that. And I think that's very true.
Were there any moments that stood out for you this past Tuesday, either positive or negative, moments as potentially memorable for voters?
Maybe so. There were a couple. One was when Pete Buttigieg, you know, said that didn't need lessons in patriotism from Beto O'Rourke. That was a big moment. You know, I think Buttigieg has really established himself and is willing now to wade in. He's no longer the new kid on the block. The other thing was, I got to say, I think Biden didn't look on top of his game. Now, this may be a one debate blip, but I really thought as he spoke this last time, he had the second most speaking time of any candidate. As he spoke, however, I thought, man, he's not connecting. He's mixing up his words. He's saying things that he doesn't want to say, and then he has to correct them. I just really thought, you know, there may be an issue there. On the other hand, Bernie did great, and he's older than Biden, so.
Yeah. Well, that makes me have to ask you, did you see any difference in Biden in the other debates?
Yeah, I thought he was a little sharper in the other debates. I mean, I think he's the kind of guy that has always had an issue speaking directly and clearly and on target, but he seemed a little off in this particular debate, and it could be that the whole thing with the Ukraine and his son Hunter, you know, that's got to be throwing him off stride and putting him in an odd space. And I can't imagine what's going through his head as he attempts to navigate a presidential campaign while the president of the United States goes out of his way to try to, you know, entrap his son in some sort of weird dealing in Ukraine and tie Russia into it, and it's you know. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Pearson, what about the incredible conflict between Congress and the president? This week, there was an overwhelming bipartisan vote to condemn the rash actions Donald Trump has taken in Syria. And the reaction was, by all reports, a childish Trump outburst in a White House meeting. Where is all of that taking us?
Well, it's taking us places we don't want to be. But frankly, you know, I'm encouraged by the speed with which things are moving. You know, this vote against Trump to censure, it's not a censure vote, but this vote that went very strongly against Trump in the House, the way the hearings are coming through, the way people are testifying, my sense is that you know, judgment is coming, and it's coming quickly. And I think that needs to play out for the good of the republic, quite frankly. I don't think that the kind of stonewalling and denial of oversight function that the Trump administration is doing is good for the republic. And I think at some point we're going to start to see a movement of the mass of Republican senators away from Trump in a self-protective mode. I think as more and more information comes out, I think people are going to start to say, okay, that's it, and they're going to move on. And maybe I'm wrong, but I see that as a very positive development, but it's definitely painful to watch.
Who's going to start that?
Well, you know, the Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, is going to start that. Collins from Maine, I think, is on the board. I can't imagine that even that outliers like Rand Paul or someone like that won't kind of get in that. Even Lindsey Graham has indicated that he's had some problems with it. I think, you know, I certainly wouldn't look for Louisiana senators to start that movement. they have shown no indication to have any kind of a backbone whatsoever. But I I'm sort of hopeful that that is gradually going to start as more and more evidence comes out.
Hmm. Okay, we got to go to Louisiana since we both live there.
I'm happy to go to Louisiana.
Here in Louisiana, the governor's mansion has been held by a Democrat for the past few years, but the recent primary saw tons of national dollars and presidential endorsements flow toward Republican Eddie Rasponi. Governor John Bel Edwards came up short of the needed 50%, meaning a runoff is coming next month. Pearson, can any of this help us understand national partisan dynamics right now, or is Louisiana just too unique when it comes to electoral politics?
Well, I wish Louisiana was a little more unique. It used to be unique, but frankly, it's kind of fallen off that. So in recent years, Louisiana is very much trending like the rest of the South. In this particular election, I was stunned by how nationalized the election was. Eddie Rasponi essentially had almost no real platform of any kind. He basically came out and said, I like Donald Trump, you like Donald Trump, you should vote for me.
And I read the Bible.
Yeah, and I read the Bible, and I'm a businessman, and that's why I'd do a better job. We don't have to talk about my plans for any of this, my plans for paying of any. It's just, you like Trump, I like Trump, vote for me. And it worked amazingly well. When he first came out, I thought, oh, my goodness, I mean, no one will vote for him because there's nothing there. But frankly, apparently, the message was there, was a very strong one. And he, you know, he basically surprised everybody, including Ralph Abraham, his Republican rival, with his stand and moved into the runoff. And frankly, if you add up the votes for the two Republicans, that's over 50%. John Bel Edwards is facing quite a challenge.
Yeah. What should our listeners know about the ongoing proceedings regarding presidential impeachment? A second poll has now revealed a slight majority of Americans supporting impeachment, even as a growing number of administration figures stonewalls congressional demands. What's going to happen?
Well, I think we're going to get, you know, it looks to me like people are starting to testify. It doesn't look to me like most administration officials are going to be able to withstand the force of a subpoena from Congress. At some point, I think Nancy Pelosi is going to have to schedule a vote in the House and vote to, a straight-out vote if she can. And that would clear away some of the objections that the White House has been throwing up as obfuscation, clearly. Because the oversight function remains unfettered. But I think looking forward, I'm really looking for some of these testimonies. I mean, maybe I'm a person who still believes in the Mueller report and what it said, but I'm really thinking that the dam is going to break at some point.
Pearson, I feel obligated to ask you this question. What's the worst case scenario in your expert opinion? Could all of what we've seen happen take this nation?
Well, I really don't like where it's taking us, and that's to an identity politics on both sides. You know, for a long time, the right has said, oh, well, the left engages in identity politics and all that. But frankly, there's no stronger identity in the United States today than Donald Trump. And if all it takes is for you to identify yourself as a Trumpian, to get people to vote for you, that's an identification that is dangerous to the country. And I'm worried, if I had to say my worst possible scenario, would be that Trump would defy, you know, the Congress in its legitimate request, and that we would have a constitutional standoff with many citizens kind of lining up against each other on the basis of pro or anti-Trump, or a pro-Trump state or an anti-Trump state. I mean, that's the apocalyptic kind of possibility, and I hope very much that cooler heads prevail and that we stand down way, way, way before we get to that, but that's looking down the road. This is a disturbing element, this identification, this identity politics, and particularly with a demagogue like Donald Trump.
You know, Pearson, I've always wanted to look ahead at the day after the election and what's happened in the nation that we have to pick up on that day. How do you see – is it going to be just a dogfight in the election itself, or is it going to be any kind – will there be any kind of coming together with the nation? How do you see it?
I don't see it ending well. So let's spin out this scenario. Say Donald Trump is reelected. I think he's going to be triumphant. I think he's going to be unfettered. I think what we've seen now is going to be rendered, he's going to be basically told you can do anything you want. It won't matter. And all bets are off on what happens after that. The other scenario would be that some Democrat beats Donald Trump, in which case Donald Trump is immediately going to call foul, call the election into question, try to rouse his followers to get into the streets to prevent the peaceful transfer of power, cast doubt on everything from individuals' votes to the status of government institutions. I'm not sure which is worse.
I see.
My wife accuses me of being a happy person to be around.
Is Louisiana going to stay red?
Yeah, for this election, it's going to stay red. I don't – we would have to be pretty far down not to be down the impeachment. And even so, this state, even if Donald Trump was dethroned, so to speak – that expression is too apt. Even if he were dethroned, I think this state would very willingly support Pence. So I think it's going to stay red for the foreseeable future.
Well, shoot. I thought that you were going to say it's going to be blue, and that was going to be the headline of this show.
Oh, I'm so sorry that I wrecked your headline. No, I'm...
Dr. Pearson Cross is Associate Dean at the College of Liberal Arts and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Pearson also hosts an incisive radio program titled Bayou to Beltway. Pearson, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio. It's always great to talk with you, and we'll touch base again as we go along.
That sounds great. It was a pleasure as always, Will.